everybody.
Hey folks, welcome. Once again, you're back with Taking It Down. It's the Alabama Takes Pop Culture Discussion Podcast, and this is, believe it or not, this is actually our normal recording time. So we're here on a Tuesday. You'll be listening to us on Tuesday. Every other Tuesday is when we're out. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Alabama Tape. I'm Blaine Duncan. Sitting in with me in just a second, I'll be joined by co-host Adam Morrow. And yeah, that's where we are today. We're going to talk TV. We're going to talk. There's a particular musical segment I want to discuss with Adam. I'm going to talk to him about that new Bob Dylan release that just came out Friday morning, has surprised everyone. So let's not wait. Let's get into that. Okay, welcome, Adam. What's up, man?
Another day in isolation, living the dream.
How's the corona isolation treating you? Not that you have it, but how's it going so far?
It's going pretty well, I think. I feel like I'm able to go for longer spells, not thinking about the world burning around us at this point, and just think, oh, I'm just in my house. You know, there was so much energy devoted to reading tweets and trying to figure out what the hell's going on. But yeah, trying to get back to life semi-normal. What's happening in the Duncan house? What do you guys?
It hasn't affected me horribly. So other than just I'm not going to work. And I'll be beginning the whole working from home thing tomorrow in full force. And so I'm not really excited about it, but it could go really well. It's hard to say right now.
Yeah, Natalie's in the next room working from home. And making phone calls and doing video conferences and that kind of thing. So everything's up in the air.
I think I'm a little ticked that they're still trying to maintain some kind of schedule on meetings and stuff. And I think we can trim some fat, but I'm also not in charge. So
yeah,
I'll try to just do the best I can, you know.
It's a good time to still have a job, I guess.
Yes. I suppose I should be more thankful about that kind of thing. And I am.
I'm not trying to point that out to you. I'm just saying it's definitely been a topic here at our house. It's like, well.
No. I said to the wife the other night, you know, we were about to sit down and watch some TV. The toddler had been put to bed. And I said to her, you know, I'm really thankful for, even though this is going on, I'm pretty thankful because, and I was referencing the fact that we're still getting paid. We still have a job. We can work from home. You know, we don't even have to be paying daycare costs right now, even though it's going to present a challenge tomorrow with a toddler running around the house for us to do video conferencing. That should be pretty funny.
Yeah,
it's going to be hilarious. I do want to touch on something. Let's get into some official Taking It Down discussion here.
Let's do it.
How is the movie marathon going? You guys have been watching a movie every night. Well, What's been playing at the Morrow Cinema Complex?
The last one that we watched, we didn't catch one either the last two evenings, but we went the classic route Friday night and watched The Wicker Man, the original, the 1973 British work of art. What a film. I'd never seen it before, and I feel like you watch things like Midsommar and kind of, like watching, it's like finding like the record that all of your favorite bands loved. Being like, oh, I get it now. This is where a lot of the stuff came from.
I've never seen it. So, but I've seen it. It's popped up on my timeline in like Twitter or something. Somebody references it, specifically critics too. So what can you tell me without ruining anything?
It's absurd in like a very British way. You know, it has that, the mixture of like a psychological thriller, but also a lot of comedy, a lot of coming out of the 60s hippie era kind of themes, I guess. I don't know. It's a good one. I mean, I enjoyed every second of it. Like as the absurdity of it started, I looked at Natalie and said, this is the greatest movie I've ever seen. Which I'm not actually saying it's the greatest movie I've ever seen, but I had such a good time watching it.
Give me a 1 to 5 star rating.
5.
Oh, that's big.
It's big.
The full five, not four and a half?
I mean, I don't, you know, I feel like you have to take it on its own terms. And mm-hmm. if you do that, I'm not going to compare it to, I'm not saying it's, you know, the greatest movie ever, but five stars for me.
Is it scary?
Yeah.
Huh.
At times. You know, it's got and a pretty masterful performance by Mr. Christopher Lee. Much younger, obviously, than maybe we think of him as. But yeah, it's good stuff. I mean, again, it's absurd, but it's definitely worth a watch.
Is that Christopher Lee of Count Dooku fame?
It is. it's pretty funny too, because you could not recognize him pretty easily at first, and then as mm-hmm. he starts raising his voice, you're like, oh yeah, I know who that is. This is Dooku. This is Saruman. Count Dooku.
Count Dooku, as I've always called him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's done other stuff besides Star Wars, believe it or not.
I've heard.
So is that it? Is that all the recent movies you guys have watched?
I'm trying to remember where we were when we caught up last week.
You had watched Brittany Runs a Marathon.
Right. We'd seen that, and we'd seen Honey Boy. Mm-hmm. We watched Black Swan. That was one that I was traveling when it came out, and everybody went to the theater to see it without me over the course of like a week. And I was like, well, I guess I'll just catch up on this one later. Finally watched that, and oh man, that was unbelievable. I don't think I've been more disturbed by a movie. Like I felt like I was just on edge the entire time, but because of stuff like her pulling it like hangnails, you know what I mean? Just a lot of great stuff like that. Ugh, great movie.
It's pretty amazing that movie came out in 2010.
Yeah. I can't believe it's been that long.
That's a Darren Aronofsky film.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh, I'm racking my brain on what else he's done. He's a pretty well-known director. He did Requiem for a Dream, right? Or am I crazy?
It has that vibe, doesn't it? Let's see.
Yeah, it does. I'm pretty sure he did.
He did.
That's probably what he's the most famous for. He did that movie Mother a couple mm-hmm. of years ago, I guess, which I haven't seen.
Recent.
So, yeah, Black Swan. That's a good one. But I don't remember a lot about it, I guess, because it's been 10 years ago.
Yeah, this is not exactly I brought one from a decade ago and one from, what, 4 decades ago? This is not a strong start for the pop culture podcast here.
We keep it topical here.
Yeah, yeah.
We are going to keep it topical, actually, because I want to talk to you about Friday. Bob Dylan released a song, Murder Most Foul, which is a quote from Hamlet, unless I'm mistaken, but I think that's a quote from Hamlet as well. But he's got Murder Most Foul out now. Just one song, but it was a chunk of a song. It was enough of a song.
It was, yeah. The runtime was 15 minutes.
17.
17, I'm sorry. Which makes it, is it his longest song ever?
Yeah, it is. Because on Time Out of Mind, he had a closer on there, Highlands, which right. ran over 16 minutes, and this one is a little bit longer than that.
I enjoy this so much. I'm looking right now at a list NPR put together, a playlist of songs that he references in this song. And the playlist is 74 songs long.
Wow.
74 reference points just to other music. And obviously there's film reference, there's pop culture, political history, whatever references stacked throughout. What a work of art.
Yeah, just for reference, this was his first original release. He's done three albums worth of cover stuff, kind of lounge. I don't know if I'd call it lounge, but certainly songs Frank Sinatra had done a lot, and he did three of those. And so this is the first original release he's done since 2012, his album Tempest. And I'd be willing to bet it really does sound like this was recorded during that time period, during those sessions, even, would be my guess. And he says he came out with a note that fans might find the song interesting, might find it interesting. And absolutely. I woke up on Friday morning and grabbed my phone. This is a bad habit, I know, but I grabbed my phone and looked at my phone. And it was one of the first things that was in my timeline for whatever social media I was checking. And I just immediately listened to it, all 17 minutes of it. And I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I did the same thing. Well, first I saw your text that said, hey, what are y'all doing? Go listen to this song. And then I think you said it two or three times, go listen to this song, go listen to this song. So I sat down with my coffee and I listened, and yeah, I'm on this NPR page, and this is what Bob Bolan has to say about it. And I agree with all of this. This is the most engaging song by Bob Dylan I've heard in decades. There's something eerie about this song coming out at this precise moment. I imagine that decades from now, the children of today will have memories of these quarantines, as I call them, sparked by songs, film, and literature of our era. So he's comparing there, you know, Dylan running through all of his references and thinking about in the future the touch points that people will have to recall today by, which now that song is one of them.
Yeah, I was wondering too when I first heard it. I did a really quick write up on the Alabama Take. It was, I wouldn't call it it kind of was a rushed write up because I was just so compelled to say something about this song. It's got that, it's got that inspirational vibe to it that you just want to say something or talk about it immediately. But I was wondering too when I was thinking, hearing the song the first two times and writing about it, like what kind of art are we going to get out of this pandemic? A lot of people are going to be stuffed inside and alone and away from their bandmates or away from their collaborators. And what's going to be the result of this? Now, this song probably written around, you know, 2011, 2012, or recorded around then. That's my guess. It sounds like that Tempest album. And I bet that's not a bad guess. Though, who knows? He could have recorded it a month ago. I don't know. And it brought to mind, what are we going to be hearing in, you know, 6 months, 8 months, a year and a half from artists?
It should be pretty fascinating how quickly this is processed by our collective conscience, you know, like what we are, consciousness, what we want to hear, what we're inspired to make. I don't know, it should be pretty fascinating because this is one of those events. I was talking about this. Reed came by my house on his walk around town. I think he just got stir crazy, and he texted me and said, hey, look outside. And he stood on the sidewalk and I talked to him from the porch.
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of talked about the great events in the last, I guess, really since popular music became what it is and how those impacted it. Like if you think about how long after 9/11 music was impacted by that, even if it was indirectly, like if, I mean, I think you could probably have more comforting and emotional songs for the next 10 years, maybe, than there would have been previous to that. And it took some time for pop radio just to shift back to kind of feel good, general party time kind of music. I don't know. Maybe that's a pretty wide net to throw, but it should be pretty interesting to see what happens after this, because it is on the order of something like that. You know, it's always weird in America to bring up 9/11 and like compare anything to it. That almost feels like American blasphemy or something, but
mm-hmm.
both in the number of people dying and definitely how affected we all are daily, this is gonna linger for sure.
I saw someone, I wish I could remember to give credit, but someone tweeted, all the celebrities and artists seem to be doing things from their home joyfully. Here's Imagine by 12 different artists.
Yeah.
And then Bob Dylan turns around and says, here's a song about murder.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty great. It stands in good contrast, man. They did not expect the blowback they got on that Imagine thing. Deserved blowback. It's like, well, this sounds really hard to cope with this situation in your mansion. You know, and Dylan comes out with this song for the end times.
It really is. And if you haven't heard it, just you know, I don't know if you can spoil a song, but if someone's listening and they haven't checked it out already, it's what he's doing, it sounds to me, and this is kind of what I wrote about, was he's using the assassination of JFK in 63 as a lens to view the crumbling of aspects of society, or maybe even society as a whole, or just the end of something big.
Yeah, that seemed to be the rub. And the way that the information is doled out over the course of that 15 minutes, it's just a Bob Dylan masterclass. And it's crazy to think that he was making music when that happened, like making important music when that happened, and he's still here to drop this all these years later.
Yeah, the Freewheeling Bob Dylan, that album was released in 63, the same year Kennedy died. So, and then on that album is Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, which could definitely be compared to this particular song, in its length especially.
Did you read any about, I'm sure that you already know a lot of this, that he was apparently pretty fascinated by the assassination? Like he had, I think later, within a year, he drove through Dealey Plaza, like insisted that the cars that he was with is like, we have to go check this. Like they drove the route basically. And he went and stood and like tried to piece it together. Just have this image of Bob Dylan, like the Dale Gribble kind of conspiracy guy out there looking around. So this is something that's been in his mind for a long time.
Yeah, apparently so. He's been running this over in his head.
Yeah.
And there are signs in the song that definitely point to him being reverent toward Kennedy, or maybe just the assassination led him to believe that it was huge. It was a turning point in America.
Yeah. And the narrator, I thought it was interesting when I looked, it's striking when I looked at the lyrics, uses the word we a lot before the action. It's like, what is he, who is the shadow person that's telling us this information about the killing? You know, what's he up to there?
Yeah, this it's a particular voice that's happening there. He there's a line in Fight Club that reminds me of this song as well that says, you know, we didn't, he's talking about that generation in Fight Club, that would have been 2001, that says, we didn't have a Great Depression, we didn't have a Vietnam War, and this quarantine, this pandemic is going to be hopefully the only thing a particular generation will have to deal with. You and I, we had the 9/11. We lived through that, obviously. And this pandemic is going to be someone's Vietnam War, someone's 9/11, someone's Great Depression. There's probably going to be a recession out of this. It just seems like that's going to happen. And so they're going to be paired together probably. And not to make a lot of it, because it's horrible, and the aftermath is going to be maybe even worse. I don't know. Economically speaking, could be very worse. So what's going to come out of this? You know, we're circling back around how we started the conversation, I guess.
It should be interesting. I mean, there's, in some ways it's really daunting, and in other ways it's the opportunity for a blank slate. In a lot of senses, like if you are maybe a more progressive minded person with your politics, you think, well, maybe now we can see why it's a good idea for everybody to have access to a doctor when they need it, things like that. Or if you're just thinking purely about film and music and literature and the arts, I mean, it's horrible that we're not able to play live shows right now, but everybody's kind of on equal footing. Like everybody's stuck at home trying to make music the same way. So in a way it's a leveling of the playing field. It doesn't matter if you have a big shot booking agent or a label or anything like that. It's kind of up to you. So maybe people will ascend out of that.
Yeah. I hope that things will get better after we dig ourselves out of this. I hope that people, there's a certain subset of culture, I think, that needs to change their mind on things.
Yeah, for sure.
So let me ask you this before we wrap the Bob Dylan song conversation. What line or couplet stood out to you upon the first listen? I'm just curious.
There were a lot, but the one that for some reason just jumped off the metaphorical page was when he listed the time that they swore in the new president. I can't remember how he phrased it. 2:38 when they swore Johnson in, something like that.
Air Force One coming in through the gate, Johnson sworn in at 2:38.
Yeah. I thought that was that detail to go from death or from the moment of, you know, the killing all the way through that. I don't know. That just seemed like a, that was to me the final piece of a masterfully told story.
Gotcha. The one, and that's a good point. The one that really stood out to me upon the first and second listen was how he took a lyric. I couldn't stop let me back up. I couldn't stop pairing this with what was going on today. Although I know he didn't write this in the last week, you know, that's probably obvious. But what stood out to me was how he took a very positive line from history and put it in the context of this assassination, which suddenly made it much more negative, which was, don't ask what your country can do for you. And that kind of, I wouldn't say shook me, but it operated on a new level, that one did it in the context of that song and what we're going through now.
Agreed.
And I don't want to get, you know, I often say this, I don't want to get political on here, but don't ask what your country can do for you. Sounds awfully familiar to me.
Yeah.
In 2020.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, well, there you go. Murder Most Foul, Bob Dylan. Go listen to it. Let us know what you think. I'm really interested in knowing what other people think about this song. So what we'll do is we'll use that as a break, and we'll come back to you on the other side and talk a little TV. Maybe lighten it up a little. Okay, just a reminder, Taking It Down is part of the Alabama Take Network of podcasts, all of which you can find on the website, thealabamatake.com. Go visit us, subscribe to us, and in a separate feed, you can find the Alabama Take podcast. That's what it's called, the Alabama Take. It's an interview podcast. Perfect opportunity to get caught up because that podcast is on a season break. So go check out who Corey Hanna has been interviewing. It's pretty interesting stuff. He sits with artists near and far. Go check that out. Also, plenty of writing up on the Alabama Take website that you can go read and catch up on. Coming up in just a second, Adam and I are going to be talking TV. Okay, man. So we're back. we're going to talk TV in general. You and I did not touch on, speaking of horrible events, we're going to keep the motif here of downers maybe a little. But you and I are both caught up on The Plot Against America on HBO. Am I right about that?
You are correct.
Yeah. We didn't touch on that last time, so I thought we'd bring it up here. That, of course, is about, if you don't know, The Plot Against America is a what-if kind of show, alternate reality kind of show based on the 2004 novel from Philip Roth. And it's, what if Charles Lindbergh had ran against FDR, which he didn't. He did not run for president. I think he might have had a one-off line that said, if I did, or maybe I should, or something like that. And he was an isolationist, had a kind of an isolationist viewpoint with World War II ramping up. He was like, let them fight their own fight. And the show does a what if. Does what if he ran and what if he won? And that's the end of episode 2. He wins the presidency against FDR. And so we haven't talked about this show a ton, not in depth. And what we'll do is, I'll tell you what, let's start generally. So, Adam, have you been thinking about The Plot Against America?
I thought episode 2, you know, I had my reservations on episode 1. We talked about that maybe because we're conditioned at this point to expect something big to happen in episode 1, like a twist or somebody dies that you don't expect, or, you know, like Dev's kind of kicked off with pretty deep intrigue all the way through. And this is a classic get to know this group of people kind of first episode. Episode 2, to me, you had a more, I was guarded in my optimism, I guess, for episode 2. And you kind of pointed out to me, well, I think it's setting it up to really take off from here. And I think it did in episode two. I was a lot more interested, invested in characters. It seemed like a... Did you catch what the time jump was? I know it was...
No, I didn't.
A lot had been set up in episode one that was resolved by episode two.
I'm not sure about that time jump. So you, what had happened at the end of episode one that episode two sort of signaled a jump there?
Well, the nephew has a new job, right? Mm-hmm. And he seems to have had that for a little while. Decisions have been made. Like Winona Ryder's character is, you know, move past her teaching job, that kind of thing. Just seemed like the story, they were unafraid to move the story forward to a point where, you know, it was the idea of Lindbergh's campaign in episode one. Episode two was him campaigning and eventually winning. I thought that was really well done.
There's a huge connection between this show and what's happening or has happened in the last 4 years of America. But it's not a direct correlation. It's not a one-to-one allegory, because Lindbergh's beliefs don't mirror what you would see in like Trump or someone. And one of the biggest things was that he was sort of an American hero for his aviation skills. And in real life, he wanted to go to World War II. And I think FDR kind of, I wouldn't say punished, but wouldn't allow him to join. Little spot going on there that Larry David would appreciate.
Our guy, our patron saint.
Yeah, so FDR wouldn't let him join, but I think he ended up being a counselor type figure in the Pacific for World War II, and ended up actually flying several missions, kind of like not letting the higher-ups know that he was doing that. I think that's what I've read about it, Lindbergh.
Interesting. I didn't realize that.
But that's real life. But in the fictional version of the show, what we have is this Jewish family in a very Jewish community in New Jersey, close to New York, Newark, actually. And so that first episode, you're right. Some people are going to call that first episode boring and not tune in again. That's my guess. And instead, I found it comforting. I found it a very calming kind of episode. We get introduced to this family, this man and wife, Jewish man and wife, and they have two sons, one of which is an artist, and he sketches things, and he is thoroughly immersed in the Charles Lindbergh myth. He's bought in, and he's sketching Lindbergh. He's sneaking off to see Lindbergh at the airport, give a speech, and he's probably not supposed to be doing that. And then we get the youngest son, who is actually Philip Roth, the author of the book. That's sort of his stand-in character, who is going through sort of a coming-of-age story. And then we get a sister, an aunt figure for those two young boys. That she's an aunt, played by Winona Ryder, and she's kind of getting brought into the Charles Lindbergh circle via a rabbi who's dating her. And this rabbi has, at the very end of episode two, gives this speech praising Lindbergh and, you know, kind of saying it's okay for Jewish people to believe in Lindbergh, right? And I don't know. I really liked that second episode, like you were talking about. The first episode, I can see how someone might say that it was boring and there wasn't a lot of action. It was totally a, here's this person, here's what you can expect from them. And the second episode was more propelling things into motion. And you talked about the nephew. He sort of a ne'er-do-well nephew, orphaned, if I'm not mistaken. Did you get the idea that he was an orphan?
I did, and he actually says that at one point, talking about that was kind of a selling point for him getting the job as the guy's driver and gopher, and that the guy, when he's trying to get him into Rutgers, he makes the call and says, we've got this brilliant orphan boy that we've got to get in. He kind of has a laugh at himself.
And episode two ends with him joining the Canadian army, because Canada has decided to be a part of this World War II endeavor, this war to stop Hitler. Okay. And Lindbergh has ran on the campaign of, I'm going to keep us out of war. We don't want that. We just got out of World War I. We don't need another one. And that viewpoint really does make sense. It's not a viewpoint I would have suspected anyone would have had, because we've got the benefit of history. We got the hindsight 2020 kind of thing, where we would say, Damn, yeah. Everybody needs to go fight Hitler. That's like the war that we actually needed to have fought.
This is, yeah, the most black and white thing to our eyes ever. It's like, oh, of course you have to go shoot Nazis.
But instead, the characters of the show and maybe even some real life people would have been like, no, we just got out of World War One. We don't want to die. That is not a viewpoint I would have suspected anyone having, but I'm glad that the show does that. It sort of shines a new light on history. And I think we're about to get into some serious matters with the next few episodes. This is a mini series. I don't think it's going to be longer than 6 or 8 episodes, right?
That's the impression I got.
Yeah. So what we're going to have is a little bit more of what's more of the anti-Semitic viewpoints. I think Lindbergh's going to be a little bit more. He's going to be doling out a lot more of those kinds of hateful things. Either that or he's going to have some mouthpieces that do it for him, right?
Right, for sure. The show is not one that I pulled up as soon as it was available to watch. I kind of put it off because, like you say, there's a lot of mirroring and parallels to our current climate, and especially the feeling of kind of the deep breath before things get crazy that was prevalent in these first two episodes. Like that's every day for us right now. We're kind of just sitting around waiting for the shit to really hit the fan. And that's what the characters are doing in this. I thought that at times it can be a little heavy handed, you know, showing the rally and showing people react. And then, the nephew who is shown to butt heads with the dad pretty often. But in this one, he seems to kind of be the only one who figured out and accepted early on that Lindbergh was going to win, that people had it in them to agree with what he says. And also kind of more of the nuanced stuff, like when he says that the rabbi speaking doesn't get their fellow Jews to vote for Lindbergh, it gives all of just, you know, white America feels okay. White Christian America. They're like, well, you know, this rabbi's okay with them. So I'm not a racist if I cast my vote for Lindbergh, which right. I mean, that's been true over and over again, but it definitely feels that way now. And I think, I mean, all I have to do is scroll through my social media to people that I haven't already unfriended or unfollowed. And they may trot out, like, you know, a guy wearing a MAGA hat who doesn't look like them is kind of like a justification for them not being an asshole.
Right. That's a line directly from the book, from Philip Roth's book, the line where the nephew says that this makes it okay for white Christian America to do to vote for Lindbergh.
It right.
Says, yeah. And we get... I think his name's Herman. Is that the father's name? The patriarch.
I'm so bad at names. That sounds right.
So we get the patriarch of the family. We'll call him Herman for now. That might be wrong. It's not Howie. We've dealt with a Howie from The Outsider. It's Herman, and he is so sure Lindbergh won't win. Which a lot of episode two just echoes those things from 2016. You know, there's just no way he's going to win. And the guy stays up all night. This is back in not the 40s. So he's up all night. You don't get your results, you know, around 10 or 11. He's up until dawn listening to the results, waiting for California to weigh in on the Electoral College. And
he loves that radio, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. I like that, how he's sort of connected to that radio. And he's got this one particular guy he listens to, who I think is a real person during that time period. And he's this radio announcer who's kind of his political figure, keeps him in his bubble. You know, he lives in that Jewish neighborhood bubble where, no, there's no way Lindbergh, people have more sense than that, and they're not going to vote for him.
Right.
And man, does that echo 2016?
It sure does. I mean, it echoes every election for me, it seems like, outside of Doug Jones, miraculous victory, where I think, well, everybody I know has a Bernie sticker, so I, you know, hopefully he can pull it out in Alabama. And obviously, no, we don't have an accurate view. No matter where we stand, probably we don't have an accurate view of how our neighbors feel you know, our proverb, not the neighbors next door necessarily, but I don't know that, that idea of what if there's a, I'm a bad psychology teacher's son here that I can't remember the term for that, where you think everybody else agrees with you. And we see Herman go through that in spades in this one. I'm sure the next one will be, the stages of grief that probably mirror, it probably gets a little more real than it did for us after 2016. But I'm sure that's going to be a big factor.
Yeah. And I keep, you know, I say that it's not an allegory, but if you kind of look at it like that, it's hard not to. If you look at it like that, episode two is 2016, I figure episode three is going to be, you know, the 2017, the 2018 stuff, as far as just what's going to mirror. So,
right. And there's a world war to figure out.
That's true. That's going to obviously be interesting in how that plays out. And I haven't read the book, so we'll, from what I understand, the first two episodes only covered like the first fourth of the book. Like they've got a lot of material to work with going forward.
Interesting. Yeah. I think it's really great. I think sometimes the plot overall can feel a little heavy-handed, but all of the characters have enough meat to their own stories that it holds up to me. Like I keep thinking about the two boys and they're kind of trying to navigate the world around them and their relationship to each other. The youngest one is clearly, like you said, it's a coming of age tale. And part of that is him watching the Blitz happening in Britain and kind of like realizing that, you know, buildings where they live can burn. It's not just people out in the field shooting at each other. This is a big, scary event. So he has to reckon with stuff like that. He's even realizing things like other kids live differently than he does. That mm-hmm. creepy friend that looks like Glenn from Mad Men.
How much does he remind you of Glenn from Mad Men?
I'm pretty sure it's the same kid. I feel like they just have, because that's Weiner's son, right?
In Mad Men. They de-aged him. That's what they're doing.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. He's a weird figure. You know, they follow people to their houses. What a weird little guy. But he's kind of putting ideas in the younger brother's mind about, you know, well, rich kids play in their backyard. They don't have to play in the street like poor kids. And so just that process of realizing where your family is in society, or that other people can judge you for things that you don't necessarily find important. I don't know. He's dealing with all of that. And the older brother is kind of reinforcing this. He tells him at one point, there's a lot you don't know about. I don't know. And then it's mirrored again with the nephew, who is kind of an older brother figure to that older brother.
Yeah, he is.
It's good stuff. Good familial relationships all around.
Once again, it's using a microscopic view of something to tell a larger story.
Right, right.
We were talking about that kind of with the Dylan song, to use the assassination of Kennedy to tell a larger story. When Dylan's pretty famous for that. And Blood on the Tracks was kind of viewed through the lens of a ending of a marriage kind of tale to view how America was breaking apart at the seams during the latter stages of Vietnam.
Right.
That's just an example.
Yeah. Yeah. Effective technique for sure.
Yeah. And I love that technique. I'm really into it. The Plot Against America seems like it's going to be a show that's going to get better each and every episode. David Simon is kind of known for that a little bit, I think, with The Wire, especially. Each episode builds and builds and builds, and it creates a very in-depth experience it usually ends up really, it pays off, is I guess what I'm trying to say. All this adds up to something huge and engrossing, I think.
Yeah, definitely an immersive experience, which is, you have to have those slow episodes to get there, to have that kind of payoff.
I want to shift into one quick thing. You have not, I'm willing to bet, I haven't heard you say, you and I talk a lot off mic, you haven't watched Tiger King yet, have you?
No, I haven't. and I don't know, I've kind of sized it up when it popped up on my Netflix homepage and thought, you know, I'm just not in the mood. I know everybody's losing their mind over it right now, but yeah.
It might be an interesting discussion to have on why exactly that has become the biggest. It's got to be the biggest show going right now, because if you go on Netflix, they now have the top 10 things that were viewed that day, or the top 10 streams, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I like that. That's kind of cool. It kind of keeps me in the loop, I think. Although, you know, 8 of those things I probably will never watch. It's very interesting to me, though.
But when you find out how much money Adam Sandler movies make. It's like, yeah, exactly. Who is watching these?
We'll find, when next time he releases something, we'll definitely see that, I bet.
Yeah.
But Tiger King has been number one for a while, and I've been watching it. I think we're about halfway through the series. Everyone else kind of binged it, it seems, quickly, but it is ridiculous, and I can see why it fits this time. It definitely takes you out of what we're experiencing now and throws you into this world that's absolutely hyperbolic. It's insane. Each time you think it's just one of those classic, kind of like McMillions from HBO. Each time you think it's not going to get any crazier than this, it does. So I know you're hesitant, but I do think that it is a good one to watch during our time. If you want to be taken out of how a certain type of insanity we're experiencing in real life, and you want another type of insanity from a couple of years ago, a much more benign insanity, I do recommend it.
I'm sure I'll cave eventually.
I recommend it on a very superficial level. Like, this is not going to speak to you on, you know, the depths of society or anything.
I'll probably cave. I'll admit.
It's entertaining. Let's put it like that. It's entertaining on a broad scale. Which brings me to my next piece. I was debating on which of these grabs your attention more. So there's a Netflix show called Lock and Key, and there's a Netflix show called I'm Not Okay With This, both of which I've debated on covering here on the podcast. Do you know anything about either of those?
Not a single thing.
Me either. Other than they're supposedly worth discussion. Maybe the only thing I know is that I'm Not Okay With This is very rooted in the vibe that The End of the Fucking World created.
Okay, I'm into that.
Yeah, it's kind of a teenager, 30-minute episodes, and that's really all I know. I think that she might get superpowers or not. I'm not exactly clear on any of that, and I want to keep it vague because I think I'm going to start that soon. And I might start Lock and Key. I don't know, but I'm probably leaning heavily into it. I'm Not Okay With This. So just a heads up for listeners, if you're, you know, if that's something you guys have watched or you want to start watching, we might talk about that. I don't know. It seems in our wheelhouse.
I think, yeah, I'm Not Okay With This. I've got it pulled up right now. Even the stills and the artwork are calling to me.
Okay. And they're 30 minutes. I like a good 30-minute drama. And I want to do one quick shout out at, which I talked to you about off mic, which was Dave on Hulu. It's one of the FX on Hulu shows. And that show, I thought it was going to be one of my, you know, 28-minute, 30-minute, just quick shows to watch every other day. But I got immersed into that. I am so looking forward to the next episode. They drop weekly, and it's about a dorky kind of Jewish guy who is a rapper, and it's got some heavy Atlanta vibes. It will definitely help if you're missing Atlanta. It's got a little of that, but man, is that show funny and just very good. I cannot believe how good it was.
Yeah, I need to check it out. There's so much television right now, but fortunately I have quite a bit of time, so time to dive in.
Lots of television, but lots of time. And I think we'll wrap there. Probably we might end up talking about I'm Not Okay With This on Netflix. If you want to watch that and join us on our watch with that, I highly recommend Dave on Hulu, FX on Hulu. Dave, I know it sounds boring, and it's supposed to, because that's part of the joke. And it's so good, so good.
I was really hoping that was going to actually be a Dave Matthews Band biopic or something.
No. There was this, what was it, like a presidential parody comedy movie, Dave, from 15 years ago, maybe. So it's not that show. It's not that movie either. This is an original show, new. And what turned me onto it was that guy, the main character, who is Dave. And he was on The Daily Show right before quarantine. And I just happened to catch his interview. And I thought, man, that guy's funny. He's actually got this real self-effacing, self-aware brand of humor. He knows he's incredibly dorky, but yet there's this turning point in the first episode where you're like, okay, toward the end of episode one, if you're not interested, it's not going to get any better for you. I'll put it like that. But man, I was blown away.
Sounds good. I'm putting it on the list right now.
Well, so there we go. That's what's coming down the pike, perhaps, in the next episode. We might have another episode this week. We might not. We'll see how things go. If not, we are out. Not this week. Excuse me. Next week. Because what we do is we are released every other Tuesday, though we may be filling the void of the Alabama Tape being off. So thank you guys for joining us. That's what's coming in the future, probably, and we will talk again. Remember to subscribe and rate us if you have a chance. All right, we'll see everyone later.